time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 29th, 2020. Leap year! It's been an interesting week. Let's begin with a big thank you, though, to all you who pledged their support of WJCU during our annual radiothon. We're pretty sure we've come within striking distance of our goal. We'll get the final numbers in a couple of weeks, but I just wanted to say thank you for all your support. Next on the agenda, actually it seems to be on everybody's agenda, is the coronavirus and how it is affecting cycling. Last week, the question for everyone was about any planned trips for 2020. There were lots of responses, and most people are staying in the United States and doing some really cool trips. But there were a few that reflect concern for having long planned tours canceled due to the coronavirus. In addition, the UCI is closely monitoring the spread of the outbreak and are posting cancellations or delays in a great many events. If you are interested in following the ongoing monitoring of pro cycling, you can log on to uci.org and check their news feed. So far, there has been little or no impact on our domestic cycling event schedules. NABS is set to open in 3 weeks in Dallas. Sea Otter will launch its annual festival April 16th. However, according to show director Don Walker, who called me on Thursday, should there be any cases of the virus in Texas, he is prepared to cancel NABS and reschedule at a later date. Please watch our social media platforms, Facebook and Twitter, as well as our Outspoken Cyclist website, OutspokenCyclist.com, for instant updates as we get the information, or you can check with NAHBS, North American Handmade Bike Show, .com. This week we'll visit with Chad Corbin of Corvid Cycles in Boulder, Colorado. Chad will be at NABS for the second time with his handcrafted titanium bicycles, including the new model MAP, acronym for More Adventure Please, a light, fast, drop bar mountain machine. We'll talk about Chad's background and his thinking about the e-bike business. Then, we'll speak with Lance Kamasaska from the Big Gear Show. I met Lance almost 10 years ago when I was invited to Urban Press Camp in Washington, D.C., and then Press Camp in Park City, Utah. Since then, Lance has been doing quite a few things within the bicycle world, but his love for events like Press Camp has come full circle with the Big Gear Show. Launching this July, the B2B2C show, Business to Consumer, will highlight not only bicycles, but paddle sports as well. We'll talk with Lance in the second half of the show. So let's head on out to Boulder, Colorado for a chat with Corvid Cycles' Chad Corbin. Hello, Chad. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, we love frame builders on The Outspoken Cyclist, and so do my listeners. They love hearing all about different frame builders, what they do, how they got there. And since I saw your name among the exhibitors at NABS 2020, coming up next month, I thought, yeah, I'll see what you have to say. So tell us a little bit about Chad and your background.
Yeah, so I am trained as an engineer. I went to school originally for mechanical engineering and then got caught up kind of in the first dot-com bubble and ended up doing a lot of programming. Moved out to Colorado, worked here for a while, and then decided to go back to school and eventually found my way to hobby frame building and then to frame building as a career.
So you went back to school for a second degree? So you have one in mechanical engineering. What's the other one?
Actually, two more degrees.
I missed one.
Yeah, I usually don't mention this, but I have a undergrad in mechanical engineering master's in civil engineering with a focus on renewable energy in buildings. And then I went on to get a PhD in architectural engineering with a focus on electric power system integration in buildings.
So it's Dr. Corbin, which we're not going to use here, but I just had to say it.
Yeah, I know.
Well, that's pretty awesome, especially since your first love clearly was frame building. And I know that you started out building some frames in steel, family and friends, went off to school, and then you came back to frame building. So you had a career track of some sort. What made you make a left or right turn?
Yeah, so frame building was a hobby and it was fun. And I, you know, enjoyed just doing that for friends and family. And I did that for a couple of years. When I went back to school, I kind of had too much else going on. So it fell by the wayside. After I got my PhD and moved out to Washington State, I started working for the national lab out there in Richland. And after a couple of years of that, well, it was hard on me and it was hard on my wife. And we took some time to kind of figure out what was going to be next. And the UBI frame building class had always been on my list of things to do at some point in my life. I had the opportunity, I took it, and something just kind of clicked. It just seemed like the natural next step for me to take. You know, when I took the class, I actually didn't think I was going to go into frame building full time as a profession. It took several months for it to settle in, but eventually it became clear that's what was going to happen.
And what year was that?
I took the class in 2017. So yeah, just a few years ago.
Wow. Okay then. All right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chad Corbin. He is the proprietor of, is it Corvid? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, exactly. Corvid
Bicycles in the Republic of Boulder, as we like to say. I have so many friends in Boulder. I wish I could get out there and see everybody, like have one big dinner and get everybody together. Maybe that'll happen someday. I'd like to know how you came up with the name Corvid.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, depending on what you believe on the internet, but I have done a little more in-depth research than that. My last name, Corbin, has its roots in an English word that means raven. And it wasn't really a far stretch for me to kind of take that concept and turn it into the brand. Riding bikes to me is kind of like flying. You've got that feeling of freedom and kind of flowing through space unencumbered. And it seemed like that, my name, and kind of just an infatuation with ravens in general was what was going to lead to that brand identity.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool bird. They are cool.
They're super cool. They're many more corvids out there in the wild than you realize. It's not just ravens and crows. It's, you know, jays, magpies, and all sorts of rooks, all sorts of other interesting birds. And they're all super, super cool. Really intelligent, very adaptable.
So. Yeah, they are smart. I mean, I've seen some things about, especially crows, that they're probably smarter than we are. They probably are smarter than we are in some ways.
Yeah,
so sure. You did start with steel. Lug steel. Now you're building tie. Is that all you're building?
Yeah, I've decided to focus on tie. It's an amazing material. It really is. I love the kind of the simplicity of it. You don't have to finish it, right? It doesn't corrode like steel does, and has better fatigue properties than aluminum. Has a nice responsive feel, and you can kind of tune that with tubing diameters and wall thicknesses, and it's just I don't know. Maybe it's because I grew up riding tie bikes. My first mountain bike was an old Park Green made by Lightspeed, and I just kind of fell in love with how those things behave on the trail, and it just seems like the natural thing to do.
I know that titanium is a very special material, and one of the cool things is you don't have to paint it. But do you offer paint if somebody says, oh, I want my titanium with panels or something like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I've done some painted frames. I've done some Cerakote frames. I've got a frame with some anodizing coming up after NABS. So, yeah, that's definitely available. I like the simple, clean look of brushed raw tie.
Yeah, me too. Me too. If some of the model names are really interesting to me in your lineup. You have the Corax, the Dirt Surfer, the Bypass. You're going to have a new frame that you're going to be introducing at NABS next month. Tell us a little bit about, let's say, the Corax and the Dirt Surfer and the Bypass. How are they different, and where are they in your lineup?
Sure. We'll start with the Corax. The Corax was a collaboration between myself and a group of fellows in Italy called Montanus, and they do some amazing video work. They do these kind of long bike packing adventures and film their rides and create these amazing videos. The one that they created in collaboration with my brand actually won bikepacking.com's editing and videography award this year. That's one of the Vimeo staff picks. Like, they do some amazing stuff. But anyway, that's a bit of a digression.
Yeah, but we do need to let people know that they can actually watch that video, because it is out there, and we'll post that, because I thought it was really, really cool.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. They did an amazing job. So I worked with them to spec out the frames that they were going to use on that shoot, and some back and forth, we settled on the geometry and features that their bike would have. It's really geared towards bike packing and unloaded trail riding. It's kind of a nice balance between a really aggressive hardtail like the Dirt Surfer and something a little more pedestrian, I guess you could say, like a like a traditional cross country bike, which is steep with geometry. So it's a nice blend of those two things, and then has mounts all over the frame for frame bags, racks, whatever.
Will it take fenders?
It can be made to take fenders. Okay. Yeah, everything I do is custom. So if you want fender mounts, we can integrate those. The Dirt Surfer is my take on a hardtail enduro bike. It's a really aggressive geometry, slack head angle, steep seat angle, very long top tube. And it's really aimed at going downhill fast. It's a style that's really popular out in the Pacific Northwest, where I've sent a bunch of frames in the last year. Those guys out there seem to love that style of riding and that geometry. So it's a super fun bike. It's actually really capable on regular trail riding too. It's just, it really does enjoy going fast. And then the Bypass is kind of a road touring bike. It's similar to the GRT or the Grit, except it's really aimed more at being on paved roads than on gravel roads. So it's fairly standard road bike geometry, a little bit more relaxed for some touring stability. Also rack mounts, fender mounts, things like that.
Nice. And what's the new one you're going to be bringing to NABS?
Yeah, so this one, it's called the MAP. Which stands for More Adventure, Please. The naming credit goes to a fellow who reached out to me to design a custom drop bar mountain bike for him later last year. So it's similar to the Corax in that it's geared towards bike packing and trail riding, but its geometry has been adjusted for using a drop bar instead of a flat bar. So slightly shorter top tube, designed around a suspension corrected rigid fork, but it can take a suspension fork and mounts all over the place. So I'll be releasing that at the show, probably put up some teasers on Instagram in the next couple of weeks or so, and working with Joe down at JPAX to do some custom bags for the bike that I'll be taking to the show. So it's going to be it's pretty sweet. I'm really looking forward to showing that one off.
Nice. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Chad Corbin of Corvid Cycles out in Boulder, Colorado. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to ask him some other questions. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on the Outspoken Cyclists. We're talking with Chad Corbin from Corvette Cycles out in Boulder. Before the break, we were talking about the different models and the different uses of the models. So have you had any requests for any e-bike versions of your bikes?
So I have not, although I would jump at the opportunity because I think that this is one of those areas where there's going to be a lot of growth. I mean, you already see a lot of e-cargo bikes and stuff like that floating around Boulder because nobody wants to drive a car around here. It's actually more efficient to be riding on the bike paths. That said, I did do an e-version of kind of a commuter bike for my wife about a year and a half ago. And she actually took the reins on the e-part of it and did a lot of research and got an electric motor kit, battery, and all that kind of stuff. And I built up a frame around that. It's a retrofit system, so you could throw it on any frame that I make or somebody else makes with, you know, it's kind of standard bottom bracket size features and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, long answer, no. Short answer, I'd love to. it's an area that I'm passionate about. You know, eliminating car trips. We have a bunch of friends around here that ride e-cargo bikes, and it just makes so much sense. You know, if it gets people out on a bike more often and out of their car, I don't care if it's got a motor on it. You know, it's all good.
I agree. You mentioned the word standards, and so I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about some of the new quote-unquote standards. I understand why through axles are being used because of the forces of disc brakes. I understand some of the other ideas that people have, but things like these enormous head tubes and these strange bottom bracket sort of configurations, what do you think about all this new stuff? Is it just new for the sake of being new, or do you see it as becoming standard and staying that way, like anything does in our industry?
Yeah, so standards are funny. It's like that saying, the only constant is change, right? Like,
right, true.
Standards on the market right now, there are hardly any standards. But the cynical answer is it's a good way to keep us all employed. The real answer is, yeah, I think there's something to it. There's a lot of trends with, like you mentioned, bottom brackets and head tubes and all of that. Largely are being driven by the larger manufacturers needing to adjust their bikes for trends like carbon fiber frames and internal cable routing, where they need to bulk up those areas, give them larger cross-sectional areas to make the frame stronger. It's kind of an aesthetic thing too. With the large head tubes, you're looking at forks that need larger steer tubes down at the bottom to make them stronger. So like an aggressive hardtail has got an inch and a half diameter steer tube at the bottom, which requires a larger bearing surface. Larger bearings, you know, the bigger the bearing, and from an engineering perspective, the bigger the bearing, the more it will last, you know, all of the things being equal, just because it spreads out that load over a larger surface area. So yeah, there's definitely something to it. There's been some experimentation, like bottom brackets, especially press-in bottom brackets were huge. And they still are to some extent on like road bikes or triathlon bikes or something like that, where weight is a primary concern. But I see a lot of people coming back to me saying, give me a threaded bottom bracket because it's easy to work on. It's easy to replace. They don't start squeaking like those press-in bearings do. And they're just kind of fed up with those types of things. So it's one of those kind of like pendulum swinging situations. I think there's a lot of experimentation and then things kind of come back to some sort of stability or equilibrium at some point. And some of those things we're seeing that play out right now.
So this is my, you know, devil's advocate question. I ask it of most frame builders. How do you feel about disc brakes on road bikes?
I'm all for it. You know, disc, there's a little bit of a trade-off, right? They do tend to be heavier. But generally speaking, the increased stopping power can be a benefit. It can also, and like if you grab a hold of a road bike's disc brakes too hard, you're going to be locking up both wheels. So you've got to be careful about that for sure. But I think generally it's an improvement. What I don't love is all of the internal cable routing.
No kidding.
As a result, it's just a pain in the butt to route hydraulic lines internally, and it makes it harder for the end user to work on their bike. You know, they have to have all these specialized tools to cut and bleed and all of that with the hydraulic line. So I'm for it. Maybe the execution isn't perfect sometimes, but yeah.
Okay.
No problem here.
All right. I'm not going to argue with you.
I mean, I'm happy to hear your opinion because, you know, I'm a custom builder. I don't know what people want.
I mean, we've come downhill very fast with caliper brakes, and people like Shimano and or Paul make great brakes. And I think a lot of it is, and I understand disc, especially if the conditions are wet, that makes a lot of sense. But what you have to do to change the front end of the bike and you know, stiffen it up and change things that maybe didn't need changing. I mean, how many millions of years did we have? Of course, that's way exaggerating. No disc brakes. And I don't know. I don't know. It's sort of like if it ain't broke, don't fix it in some ways. Whatever.
Yeah.
Let's talk.
That's a good point. I didn't hit on the frame design aspect of it, but you're right. There's definitely some considerations for beefing up those areas of the frame and for, you know, but, you know, that's fairly easy to accomplish.
Oh yeah. No. It's not like you can't do it. It's sort of like, okay, so we have to do this to do that. And some of me is a retro grouch. You know, being in the industry for way longer than, you know, a lot of other people. Let's move on. So I want to talk about your process. Each bike is made to order. How do you accomplish your fittings?
Yeah, most of my frames are ordered remotely, let's say. So somebody who's further than driving distance away. So in those cases, I'll either have them go to a bike shop or a professional fitter and have them take the dimensions I need and then coordinate with the fitter to draw up the frame design and make sure that I'm hitting the numbers correctly. Sometimes people are fairly comfortable in what they're riding already and see no reason to change it. So in that case, I take some key dimensions off of their bikes or have them do it and work my frame drawings based on that. So, you know, somebody has a touring bike that they like, but they're just looking for some upgrades in material or components or just want something that'll, you know, carry them through the next 20 years or whatever. So in that case, I taking dimensions off the bike is usually the way to go. A lot easier and it's cheaper for them.
Sure.
If somebody's relatively local, I'll meet up with them, take dimensions of their bikes, and then grab some body dimensions, and then I run that through a fit calculator. I mean, caveat, I am not a professional fitter and I don't pretend to be. So in those cases, you know, it's a discussion with the customer, like, how comfortable are you with, you know, me doing this versus having a professional fitter. And, if they have some special considerations, I will definitely send them to a professional fitter. Like if they've got some back issues or some mobility issues or things like that, I'll say, look, you know, this is where an expert needs to intervene and have a professional fitter do it. But yeah, otherwise it's pretty simple, kind of based on what they're riding with some minor adjustments.
I think that your approach is very interesting and very good. I'm a professional fitter, so I can appreciate that a builder would say, I may not be the best at this. And where it often goes wrong is if somebody has an issue, like a knee replacement, a hip problem, a back problem, you know, broke that proverbial broken collarbone, whatever it is. So, yeah, I can appreciate that. You don't take it personally if somebody says, I'm going to go to a professional fitter, or that you actually send them to one. I like that.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, you know, depends on the type of bike, too. I just go on with just a little bit more. You know, road bikes tend to be a little more finicky in terms of fit than, say, a mountain bike. You know, mountain bike, you're moving around all over the place. You got to get some things right, but it's less critical with some of those off-road bikes than it is with a road touring bike or something like that.
True. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Chad Corbin of Corvid Cycles out in Boulder. How are your clients finding you?
The internet's an amazing thing.
It is, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So it started out with friends, right? As all, I think, frame builders realize, your first customers are going to be your friends, and they're not going to pay much for their bike. And then, you know, they start providing a network, a nexus of other opportunities. So friends of friends, and, you know, eventually it moves into random calls from somebody saw your bike in a magazine like Mountain Flyer or on bikepacking.com or something like that. But, you know, a lot of it is definitely through social media. I'm pretty active on Instagram, not so much on the other platforms, but, you know, Instagram's a great place to show off your work and to get some interest. So I use that quite a bit. If I could figure out a better way, I certainly would. But yeah, it's mostly social media and trying to get my stuff in front of traditional media to kind of bolster that.
It's interesting how social media has changed the way we do business. You know, in some ways we look at it and say, oh my goodness, it's killing retail, but it is helping people like you who are these crafts people, these artisan builders. So I think it's awesome. Who are your clients? Who is coming to you generally for, other than your friends and relatives?
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of demographics, I'd say it's in the, you know, 30s to 50s folks that are looking for something that is made for them. They don't necessarily need a new bike, but they appreciate custom craftsmanship, and they are looking for something that's not a big brand. And they tend to be more men than women, and that's a bummer because I feel like, I hate talking about women as a market, but you know, it's an underserved market. Things are designed mostly for men, and the fit is never really right for women. And so I'd love to be doing more in that area. I guess in terms of profession, it ranges. You know, it's all over the board. Lawyers, doctors, engineers,
sure.
Trail builders, forest workers, you know, just it's all over the place.
Yeah,
I haven't figured out anything to that yet.
What's your queue these days? How long's the wait?
It's about 8 weeks right now.
Not bad.
I've got stuff scheduled out through the end of April.
Middle
of May or something like that. So yes, I can't complain.
So something I saw on your website, go no go. What is your go no go? I happen to understand what it is, but I think an explanation to listeners would be interesting.
Yeah, the go no go, or I call it the go nog. It's just a fancy ruler. So it's a frame building tool. It's designed to help you lay out and design chain stays, the chain stay bottom bracket. Chainring area is always a problem, just because there's a lot of stuff going on down there. It's really tight. So it's a tool to help with the design of stays and for fixturing your stays, making sure nothing's going to interfere, and then for checking crank and chain ring clearance after you've tacked up the frame before you do your full weld and do something irreversible. It was kind of it's an evolution of a cardboard version that I made when I was working at another frame builder. We used to just take the tacked frame out of fixture, throw a bottom bracket and crank in there and check.
See if it worked.
It was it's just a big waste of time. Like,
sure.
There was no point to doing it after the fact like that. So I made up some cardboard templates and then it turned into this slightly fancier version.
So is it available yet?
Well, actually, I'm meeting the fellow that will be doing the laser etching in about an hour. So
cool.
I'm going to update the website and it will be available for purchase. I mean, it's a pretty niche thing, right? It's other frame building dorks that are going to be buying it. But
well, I know a lot of frame building dorks.
But yeah, it'll be available on the website probably this afternoon.
Cool. So did you make your own fixture or are you using somebody else's?
So I use an anvil fixture.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, I do. I use a lot of anvil tooling in it, which is, that anvil's gotten out of the business.
Right. Yes. No, I know. He's also disappeared from social media. It's interesting. He said, I'm gone, and he was gone.
Yeah. There's random posts of like yaks and buffalo.
Right. He and Jill. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Don's off enjoying retirement and playing around a bunch. But anyway, so yeah, he leaves the hole. There are others that are stepping in to fill that hole, but it's an anvil main fixture, anvil seat and chainstay fixtures, anvil benders. And then I have other fixturing or tooling that I've made for doing my machining operations.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Pretty simple stuff.
Cool. So unfortunately, we have to wrap this up, but I have to ask you these questions. And I haven't done this in a while. You're my first one this year. So here we go. What's your favorite food?
Oh, man.
See, why is this such a hard question for people? It cracks me up.
I love eating.
Okay. All right, pick something.
There's this little Vietnamese place here in Boulder called Che Thuy, and it's cheap and delicious. I love it.
There you go. What music do you listen to?
It's a weird mix of stuff. It ranges from contemporary classical to electronic glitch. So it's all over the board, but generally it's something without lyrics. It's too distracting.
Right, exactly. Wait, I have to listen to this? So I already know that you don't have any pets, so I'm going to ask you a different question, and that is, what do you do when you're not building frames? And do not say, I am out riding my bike. Say something different. Please.
I do some trail running. Lately, I haven't had a ton of free time, though, so it's hard to say. I've gotten more and more into photography, which is also one of those kind of background interests that's been there for many, many years. So I'm trying to get out and enjoy nature and take some more photos when I can.
Well, that's awesome. It's just been wonderful talking with you. We've been speaking with Chad Corbin. He is the proprietor of Corvid Cycles at CORVIDcycles.com. He will be exhibiting at NABS. Is this your first NABS?
This will be my second.
This is the second NAB, so he's heading for Dallas next month. Thank you so much for talking with me. Much luck with your work this year, and we'll probably catch up sometime again.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All righty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Chad Corbin joined me from his shop in Boulder, Colorado. If you're heading to NABS, you can stop by the booth and say, hey. Or if you're interested in seeing what's on tap at Corvid, including the new map model, you can log on to corvidcycles.com. That's CORVID. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Lance Kamasaska from The Big Gear Show. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. A bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights. We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Salt Lake City Convention Center will be the site of the first big gear show launching this July. Retailers especially will be given some great incentives to attend the show, and consumers will be invited to stop by and see what's in store for cycling and paddling. Here's my conversation with show director Lance Kamasaska. Hello, Lance. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. How have you been?
I have been great, and it's really a pleasure to talk to you. It's been a while.
It has been since press camp. So tell me what you're up to. And we do know we're going to talk about the new big gear show, but I'd like to hear what's been going on in the sort of intervening years.
Sure. Well, press camp wrapped up the media events. In particular, wrapped up in, what was that? It was the end of 2017, and I took a deep breath and started to consider a lot of different options, whether I wanted to continue doing events again with a couple of new ideas I had in my back pocket, or did I want to join another team and work with manufacturers again, which is where I got my start. And frankly, I missed some of that. I really enjoyed being the quarterback of one of the cycling industry's brands. So I really took a deep breath and looked around a little bit. And in the interim, I got a few jobs, which I kind of hung a shingle for, which was to consult on events and try to work with people to do a better job, whether it was a consumer event or, you know, a business-to-business trade event. I always see people making pretty big mistakes, and I see them spending money when they shouldn't, or maybe not spending enough money where they should, and that type of thing. And I had an eight-month project with SRAM. I was a part of doing all the logistics of their Axis launch, which was a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
17 days long in Tucson, Arizona. That was last year in 2019, but just a fabulous event. I was really, really proud to be a part of that. And I came out of that project and started looking again. And all of a sudden, by the end of 2019, I started hearing about the big gear show. Started to poke around a little bit to see what it was all about. And ended up on a telephone call with the owner. Well, there's two owners, actually. A guy named Sutton Bacon is the CEO, and he's the main contact. And another gentleman named Darren Bush. And after probably a 45-minute call with Sutton and learning more about his background and his vision and what he wanted to make with this event, I was super excited. And little did I know, he was thinking of me. So it was a great call, and 6 days later, I was hired. And that's kind of where we are right now.
That is where we are right now. And we are going to talk about the big gear show. So when I started Outspoken Cyclist, which was many years ago, mm-hmm. first, what, almost 10, if you can believe that, I'm the old lady of podcasting. You guys invited me to press camp. First, it was Urban Press Camp in D.C. Then I went out to Park City. And that was such an interesting event. And it was very different from what big gear show is going to be. So, as I remember, press camp was focused on getting the media in to look at new product, try new product, report on new product. What is the big gear show? We have no Interbike anymore, so I'm looking at it and going, tell me exactly what big gear show is.
Sure. Well, I'll start by just explaining briefly what press camp was. So you maybe that idea and what that was will kind of play into what the big gear show is becoming. But the press camp event was really an opportunity to put medium-sized brands together which would attract the media in group. The best way to explain it probably is that smaller to medium-sized brands just don't have the clout or the resources to hold media roundups on their own. But when you put a bunch of really inspiring little groups of manufacturers together, it becomes attractive, and people like yourself would attend. Very unique. It was very successful and probably would even still be today. But as everybody probably knows, the landscape for events is changing pretty dramatically. And I think particularly with a newer generation of people doing marketing and sales, they want to get the most bang for their buck. They want to do as many things as they can do at an event. They want to set the time aside, and they want to work really hard, and they want to come home and be done. It's a little different than it was maybe even 10 years ago, where I think Press Camp, as successful as they were, and people made the time for them, I'm not so sure that would be the formula that would work today. So moving a little bit forward, in speaking with Sutton, as I alluded to earlier, he had this vision that, well, it's kind of complicated, but I'm going to try to make it really simple. The outdoor industry, which was at the core of his idea, had a bit of a kind of a default thing going on where the show was actually being almost taken over. I'll use the word taken over by apparel and soft goods and fashion. And he felt in his time, and he was in the paddle sports industry for years, his time as an exhibitor at outdoor retailer was finding that the hard goods products were being overlooked. And the show was being, like I said, driven by apparel and fashion and a lot of puffy jackets and a lot of sandals and surfwear and that type of thing. And the paddle and the hard goods business were kind of being pushed to the side. And he thought that was a grave mistake for them and thought that there would be a need for hard goods manufacturers to come together specifically. And then his idea went even further. He thought the cross-pollination of bringing his paddle colleagues together with outdoor and then invite bicycles in would be a peer-to-peer hard goods show that could really accomplish a lot in terms of product presentations to buyers, education, demoing, and then finally a consumer day. This was this giant vision he had. And, you know, personally for me, when I heard that, I immediately thought of the obvious. And the obvious was, you know, anybody who rides a bike probably does some hiking. And anybody who does some hiking probably does some paddling. And anybody who does some paddling probably rides a bike. It's just a giant circle of activity with the active lifestyle. And that was the first impression I had. Then I thought, going back to my earlier point, I can see manufacturers getting quite excited about this because they do want to meet with consumers. I mean, business, you know, B2C is a big part of many, many businesses today. They want to meet with the media. They want to have their B2B conversations. They are keenly interested in education. And frankly, they want to do it on a national level one time a year. And that was what Sutton's vision was, is to have one very productive assembly of these different industries coming together. And then the added bonus would be that peer-to-peer part of it, which is, you know, retailers coming in for bicycles may learn a little bit from outdoor, and people from paddle may learn a little bit from bicycles, and so on and so forth. And after I had that conversation with Sutton and saw some of my own visions, and he added his visions, I said, this is a home run. And I got super excited. And that's really where I think a lot of these industries are. They want to get a lot of bang for their buck, do a lot of great things, spend 5 days, and come home complete. And that's what this event's going to attempt to do.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lance Kamasaska. He is now the, I guess you're the show director for the Big Gear Show, and it's coming out in July. I have some questions about the show itself and who will be exhibiting and who will be attending, but I want to just go back to something that you said about this sort of circle of sports. I couldn't agree with you more about the sort of short shrift that hard goods has gotten over the years. So I don't go to outdoor retailer. I've never been, but I am aware that walking into stores that used to be big outdoor stores that sold lots of hard goods, you know, really good backpacks, really good tents, really good poles, really good hiking, you know, equipment, camping equipment, do not any longer look like that. They look like an apparel store. So I think this is really a cool idea, and I'm really excited. So who so far has decided to come and exhibit at Big Gear Show. Do you already have a list of exhibitors? I'm sure you do.
I do and I don't. I'm going to be brutally honest with you, because we intentionally, we had three, I call it three legs of the stool. When we all came together, and by the way, this whole group of ours is about seven of us, came together on January 7th. And we began to brainstorm. I mean, the event had been launched, but the content and how we were going to go about it, our strategy, wasn't yet to be set. We got together on January 7th and decided we were going to create the three-legged stool, which I'm alluding to. And one of the legs was to build a compelling story for retailers in all three of these product segments to learn about our concept, learn about really everything I just told you, Diane. And we set out in doing some marketing and some outreach to all the different retailers. And we created a retail subsidy program as well, where retailers would earn some subsidies against their lodging if they heard our story and got involved early. So that was step number one. Step number two was to launch our demo, which we just did on Monday of this week. And then step number three, the third leg of the stool, is we're going to be announcing all of that peer-to-peer educational opportunities that I've alluded to. So there's three giant features of this event. And I purposely, although I was fielding many, many calls and taking emails and making some calls to different brands, I really wasn't pursuing contracts or getting them in just yet. I really felt I had to have the retail component part of it behind me, and I also needed to have the demo announced, where then I could go back to some of the bigger brands that I've been talking to, which includes Specialized and Giant and SRAM and Pivot and some of the big names that everybody knows. But I purposely waited because I wanted to have my best foot forward. And I wanted to have those two cornerstones of the event behind me. And that's exactly where I am today. So even with not having big brands committed yet, I've actually had some line of communication or some registration or some commitments already from 56 brands.
Wow.
And some good brands. I mean, there's some names in there you would definitely know, but I'm not posting it yet because, I want to build the other ends of the mall, if you will. When I finish this week and next week, circling back to some of the big interests we had early, and we can talk about who's registered, where they're coming from.
Apparently, you've already contracted with the Salt Lake City Convention Center. Is that right?
That's correct. Oh, that was done in December. Yeah. So our commitment is with the Salt Lake City Convention Center for all of our B2B activities. Indoor B2B activities.
And outdoors at
Deer Valley.
At Deer Valley, which is really awesome. But tell me why you picked July.
Well, that's actually an interesting question. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what is optimal. And of course, it gets even more confusing. It's really confusing when it comes around with three different segments and three different opinions from those different segments. But we felt that, I mean, there's a school of thought that kind of sits with me, that many bicycle retailers, although they may say their knee-jerk reaction is, oh, that's the busiest time of year, but it's also probably the time that they're best stocked with personnel and workers and help. And we've noted over the years that, you know, when Specialized and some of the big bike brands, Trek and others, you know, held their dealer meetings, they did them in July or they did them in August or they did them in June. And their thought pattern, I think, was similar to ours, is if the shops are most equipped with personnel and help, that's probably the best time for them to sneak away and attend their event. So why wouldn't they, you know, attend an event like this? It also worked out really well for, I think, in cycling, because it is not too late, which we know September and the Interbike Show was criticized for, particularly in the last decade,
right,
of being too late, you know, after the season. July is before the season's over. It is kind of a product launch time, a landscape, true of outdoor as well. Outdoor does a lot of hard goods launching in the middle months of the summer. And paddle, the other part of our events segment composition, they've always had an event in late July, August. So for them, that was just right down the main street for them. So a lot of factors went into it. There's a lot of, you know, tug and pull and push, but I think July is going to work.
So one of the things that occurred to me while you were explaining your thinking on it is that retailers are past their spring rush of service. They're also probably past the largest part of the season of selling a new bike. And so a lot of people are already putting things on sale. They're looking at fall. They're looking at different ideas. I don't think it's a bad month. I just wondered what your thinking was. In fact, I think it's a good month to get away. You know, it sort of breaks up a really hectic season for cyclists and for bicycle retailers.
I completely agree. I think the surge is over, too. Like you said, that's a really good point.
Yeah. So what do you think the show reflects in terms of how people are viewing the bicycle business today? There's a lot of griping in the retail industry because of online. And I'm sure it's the same in paddle. And I'm sure it's the same in all outdoor. You know, it's like go to Amazon and order anything you want and sit on your ass and just get it delivered the next day. But I think that who you're targeting is probably a little different customer. And so do you think this does reflect the outdoor business, including bicycle and paddle, this kind of show?
I really do. I mean, to your point about the digital concerns and where people's, you know, heads are at and some of the depression we're seeing, you know, on social media, people making this comment and that comment about digital losses and that type of thing, you know, is really at the heart of what we're trying to do with our education. In fact, Brandi Lipak, who you may know, she's the president of the MBBA, and she is an absolute, you know, house on fire. I mean, she's got so much energy and she's really smart and very bright. And I'm really enjoying my time with her. And we're talking literally every day in the film because she's leading the committee that we've assembled for this educational track or sessions, I should say. And key to that, and at the center of that, is going to be a lot of conversations about digital, and not maybe some of the more typical things that we hear at the BLC or other places where we assemble, but really putting, again, this peer-to-peer, you know, retailers talking to retailers, and this time not just bicycle retailers talking to bicycle retailers. It's going to be inclusive of having some outdoor representation and paddle representation. So we're going to get a lot of different points of view, a lot of success stories that maybe we can share with one another, maybe some of the do's and don'ts and that type of thing. I don't have the speakers quite lined up yet with Brandy's support, and we don't have the content exactly dialed, but I mean, the spirit of it is really exciting, and I think she's doing exactly the right thing.
So what I'd like to ask right now is that you give listeners, and we do have retailers who listen to the show, a few. I'm not sure how many, but if you would give them and my listeners a way to find out more about the Big Gear Show. I do see on the website that a qualified retailer is going to get some money back to register and apply for lodging reimbursement, which is a really cool thing, but that's coming up really fast. That's coming up Sunday. So the show will launch on Saturday and not a whole lot of people will hear it until Sunday or Monday, but you know, we'll see what happens. But go ahead and give people the information that they need to get in touch with you.
Sure. Well, first off, I got to give compliments. Our marketing and communications director, Gavin Young, does a wonderful job of updating our website every day with new information and making sure that everybody's on top of all the programs and features that I've been talking about. And all of that lives under www.thebiggearshow.com. The retail subsidy is broken down in all the pieces of it on those pages, and the page called Retailers, and that's where you find the information about the subsidy. It does expire on March 1 at its full capacity, but it will continue on for weeks and months thereafter at a different rate. It's not quite as rich as it is right now, but it does continue. So there's always going to be a subsidy for retailers to come, and we welcome them to take advantage of it.
Excellent. Well, Lance, I'm really excited for you. I think it's a great project for you and one that fits right in your wheelhouse. And I appreciate you giving me some time to talk about it, especially now since we're coming on the deadline for the big reimbursement for retailers. So thanks so much. Good luck. I wonder if I'll see you at Sea Otter. Are you going to be out there?
I will be at Sea Otter for the BLC and the event itself. Yep.
Good. Well, you're going to, if you stop by the media tent, I'll be doing on the ground podcasting for the duration. And it'll be nice to catch up with you again.
I'll definitely make a point of that. It's really great talking to you again, Diane.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Lance Kamasaska joined me to chat about the Big Gear Show opening July 22nd and running through July 25th. If you are interested, you can log on to thebiggearshow.com. So that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll talk with Joe Braun of the Licking Valley Century in Southern Ohio, and we'll have a lot more for you, too. This week's question, for those who would like to weigh in, of course, do you follow pro racing? And if so, what's your favorite event on the calendar? Log on to our Facebook page and leave us a comment. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Outspoken Cyclist without the E. And yes, I do have an Instagram page, but words are so difficult to photograph, so I don't have much content to share there. But OutspokenCyclist.com is a great place to see links to what we talk about on the show, as well as read all the synopses of each week's podcast. So thanks so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.